Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this. It is Pilots Episodes, the even less frequent flying podcast than ever before. I am JB, and I'm joined, as always, by our three pilots. I'll nip around the room now. So, Godders, how are you?
I'm all right, mate. Happy to be back in Blighty.
Yeah, are you allowed to say where you've been
on,
or anything?
Kept it on the down low, but I've been away for the last 6 months, hence the slightly infrequent pods.
Yeah, so you're allowed to say where you've been?
Yeah.
Seychelles. Been in the Seychelles over an elongated COVID
I've been
holiday.
Defending the Seychelles is a particularly tricky beach,
but some air commodore has to do it, don't they? Was a drinks reception in Antigua. You had to go.
Yeah, exactly. There was an opening of a building. All sorts of things going on, all connected with carriers. No, I was in the Combined Air Operations Centre in Al Udeid in Qatar as
the social representative.
The social / government openings rep in there as the director. So I was directing all of the air power across the Middle East.
That's incredible. I mean, I don't know how much I can ask you about that, so I probably won't ask you anything. So you don't have to explain it. In fact, if you want to pipe up with some information later on, do so on your own, in your own time. So we don't trip you up there.
No, I tell you what, it was an absolutely brilliant job. It's really good to be home because although I left in lockdown, I was pretty much locked down out there, and I've arrived back into lockdown again. So I am desperate to go and see a pub at some point in the near future. But
all desperate to go and see a pub.
Yeah, brilliant job, brilliant people. Not something I've done before, working a command air operations centre, and so to see the command and control and that side of it from the inside, especially during a pretty exciting time with the election, U.S. election, because it was an embed job with the United States Air Force, so working with all those guys. My deputy was an F-22 guy who was utterly brilliant. Some awesome stories about F-22. I love that airplane even more. But I'm sure we'll get into it in various parts. Yeah.
You know, given that just before we came on air, you said I cannot talk anything about it, I think that's an epic fail. You do know that we're now recording. You've just said everything that you went and did.
I haven't said anything that I went
and did. I
said
nothing.
Innocence.
I ain't said nothing. I directed a bit of air power. Yeah. little bit.
Just like a grand air traffic controller.
I never actually got on the radio. If I'd have got on the radio, things had been very, very serious. Yeah. I had people for that.
A man.
Just on lockdown and all of that nonsense. We're obviously locked down over here. When you go over to a job like the one that you've just come back from, God, what exactly are the working hours like? Because I don't imagine lockdown would have made a shred of difference to you anyway.
No, the lockdown was just, because there's a massive base over there. And the lockdown aspect was purely to be able to work through COVID. So the same sort of restrictions we've got over here of how many people you can have meeting rooms, wearing a mask, you know, those sorts of things. But you're right. I mean, it's a 24/7, operation clearly and has been for a long time out there in the Middle East. And so I was on call 24/7. So set of phones in my room and, was always tied to a phone at some point. But it was reasonably long days sometimes, and sometimes 7 days a week, you know, depending on what was going on. But, you work through it and, it was fine. It was good.
Excellent. And the guy who just can't contain himself, he's very, very excited. It's Dunk. How are you?
I'm always excited. Always excited. I'm all right, apart from the snow's grounded us today, which is a little bit of a bummer. No flying today.
Think you got freezing fog tomorrow as well, Dunk. So you could,
I know, it's not looking good, is it? It's like, yes, it's a very long
secretly
weekend.
Go on the lash and you'll be absolutely fine.
Okay. we never did. That never happened, by the way. We never
say nothing.
What, drinking on the weather?
Never.
Never at all.
It is the only way for freezing fog to clear.
It is.
Get Ming Mong, and it will be Jinners tomorrow.
Yeah. Just out of interest, when do you start teaching pilots to fly in freezing fog? Because I imagine at some point you're going to need to do it.
Well, that is a good question. And generally, it's a little
Don't
bit...
Don't ask tricky questions, JB.
It's a bit, further down the line. And the reason is the aeroplane, because we're at the elementary stage, our aeroplanes actually are not allowed to fly in icing conditions. So if there's a chance of icing, then we don't go into it, which is a great shame. But there you are. It means that when the freezing fog hits, we if we could go to the pub, we'd go to the pub. But we can't, so we just go home.
But most jets, Dunk, if it is visibility Zippo, then you know we haven't got the sort of systems, or most fast jets haven't got the systems that, you know, the auto lands that the airliners have, that come down and, you know, do a we need a civvy airline pilot on, but we're going to do a Cat 3 ILS. She hands off and the aircraft will land itself. So there is freezing fog can stop play for all of us.
Really? Yeah. What, even for you guys in Typhoon or F3?
Well, you could take off in it. As long as you can see enough visual references to get airborne, you can get airborne. The trouble is that for the majority of systems that we have, and the we work to an instrument rating system such that you kind of start and you might be allowed down to 500 feet. So if there's a cloud base of 500 feet, you can come in. Then as you get a bit more hours and experience, goes to 400 feet. But the lowest that we can go is 200-foot cloud base. And that's not very high, to be honest. That's a pretty low cloud base. But as soon as it gets below that and the visibility gets down to sort of mist and fog sort of visibility that you would know, then it's quite difficult to land as you can't see the runway. So you can take off as long as you're going somewhere else.
Ah, I see.
So you can fly in it, you can't land back.
I'm not...
Yeah, so I was just going to say, on QRA, JB, you can take off, and you know, it could be tasked to take off at any single point. If you haven't got any diversions, then clearly that's a big call to make us take off. But they will do, because you can launch tankers that can refuel you or drag you to different bases. You know, we could have a diversion over in Norway, up in Iceland, somewhere else in the country, where you could always go and land, because you will never have freezing fog over the entirety of the country, and so you can always refuel your way out of it.
Oh, I see.
And the worst place for that would be the Falklands. You know, that fog rolls in there, and you know, tankers have launched and refueled the buoys, or they've had to go elsewhere. You know, it's because there's not many diversions down that neck of the woods. So if fog suddenly does roll in, it's one of those horrendous weather.
Where would get
pretty tense.
Where would you divert to? Like, is there another airstrip on a different island, or is it over to Chile?
No, but yeah, different country. Boys have gone around, exactly. Chile, gone up to Uruguay, you know, but you're talking a long, long flying time. So you would need the tanker, which you would then scramble.
Oh, my word. And the tanker can land, can't it? Because effectively, it's just a passenger aircraft with fuel in it.
Good question. Got us?
It depends. Depends on the airfield, especially with the new tankers that we've got, you know, with the Airbus A330s, so they've got all the modcons on board. But so it depends where they're going back to land to, and what
they
facilities
do,
are
I
at
right?
the station.
Well, they do, but am I right in thinking, can they use them? He asks a leading question.
I don't know whether Bryce Norton has got autoland or any of that sort of stuff. So I don't know. It's a simple answer on that one.
Mm.
not Bryce nor Norton, you know, the lowest category of Instagram.
But with the there was a boomer drop the other day, wasn't there? I saw on the news there was queue scrambled, and it had pictures on I think it was the BBC News of just people videoing of whatever they were doing, you know, putting their shopping in the car when the boom was dropped, and they suddenly went wide eyed, like, what the hell was that?
Yeah, I think it was over Cambridge, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it?
Well, I told you about that time when we were moving into our house in, we just moved into Sumter in South Carolina in the US, and we had some mates over. And they were helping us move some stuff off of a truck. There was a sofa had arrived, and the boys dropping the stuff off were actually from the Air Force base up the road where I was due to go and work. And our house was under the local range, Poinsett Range, where they do high altitude bombs, strafe, you know, all sorts of stuff. And just as we were carrying a sofa into the house, there was this massive explosion. At which point, me and it was Rog Holmes, dived into a hedge and kind of looked out and were like, what the hell happened there? It sounded like the whole of the back end of the house had blown up.
The brave Air Commodore again.
Yeah, exactly.
Leaps under the table. Yeah.
His cocktail went everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. There was martinis all over the place. As these two blokes walked past, they went, it's all right, we're in the Air Force. That was a sonic boom from the jets overhead. We were like, yeah, we knew that. I was just checking the pipes. But I tell you what, being underneath it, because they were directly above in the range on what a park you'll remember, it, a high-altitude release bomb, where it could be pretty sporty in a slippery F-16. And someone had gone supersonic, and genuinely, I thought a bomb had gone off. It was that loud, so you can see that. Wow. See why people would be big, wide-eyed about the whole thing once they'd heard it, putting their shopping in the boot of the car.
Ah. Hey, now just going back to fog and diverting and all that sort of stuff. Now the other thing that can prevent aeroplanes landing is dust, and sort of in operational theatres, there was certainly. When I was over there, I had a really quite hair-raising moment when it was a beautiful, beautiful blue skies day. And I was off with a colleague of mine doing a patrol, looking after a convoy and escorting a convoy. And I'd had to take off earlier than my mate. And he'd arrived about 15 minutes later. Anyway, I sort of start going home on minimum fuel and get told here over the radio, you need to come back now because there's a dust storm and you need to divert. I said, well, I can't divert. So the diversion airfield was beyond where I was going. I said, I don't have the fuel to divert. Have you got a tanker? And they said, no, we haven't got a tanker. Yeah. I was like, oh, okay. So I just said to the air traffic controller, an American guy, can you just feed me in and then just bring me down as low as you can? And luckily we had GPS in the aeroplane, because when we got to the low as you can point, and luckily again we were in a Harrier, so we could fly pretty slow, so I slowed down as much as I could, still couldn't see the airfield at 200 feet, so just kept going in and asked the guy to keep talking to me about where the airfield was. And out of the dust loomed the tail of an Ilyushin 76. And I knew where that was parked on the airfield, although I couldn't see the runway. And so I could then go right and left, and then the runway sort of loomed out, I don't know, 50 feet or something like that.
The first thing you saw was the tail of an aircraft.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So you must have been quite close to it.
Dunk, were you on the Reds when we dived into somewhere in Saudi when we were heading back west?
Yeah.
And we were trying to get... and. The diversion, I'm a bit vague, much later, but we still arrived, I think, with probably 10 Hawks as information. And it was sort of okay, but it was gloppy viz, you know, maybe sort of 3K, but just kind of getting worse.
Into Tabuk, wasn't it?
It could have been. And it was one of those, it was when you then look in different directions, it suddenly gets really bad. But I remember we just broke into the circuit, turned downwind. And normally you're quite close behind the jet in front of you, land after each other, do an oval sort of circuit, and you just follow the jet in front of you. But none of us could really see the jet ahead, and it all was pretty smeg. And we landed, sort of parked the jets, and it was like you're wearing kind of a yellow visor where the world looks really weird, or an orange one. And it was like the bizarrely, the aircraft almost looked green because of the amount of dust and stuff, and probably got worse as we tacked it in. But it was spooky and utterly weird. The only time I've ever sort of flown in such bad, weird visibility. I guess it was it must have been a dust storm coming in.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you can feel it in your teeth, can't you? It gets into your mouth. And I'd said on the radio to my mate that was still out there, because he had more fuel than me, come back now. But he had to do the same thing. He didn't have enough fuel to divert. And I'm sure I looked exactly.
Hang a left at the illusion. You can't miss it.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, he was white as a sheet when he got down there, and I'm sure I was as well when I got out.
Do you remember flying in Norway, where you'd have a guy in the tower? So we'd always have a duty pilot in the tower, because a lot of Norwegian flying is, so the airfield colours, red is really bad, which is what we're talking about here. You know, the weather's on the deck, you can't see anything. Blue is the nicest. And Norway would go from blue to red in about 10 seconds as a big snow shower would turn up on the airfield. And so time and time again, you'd have a weather recall saying there's snow inbound, everyone needs to get back. And being Norway, a lot of the other bases were closed for snow as well. And you'd thrash around, you'd turn up, you'd land. And I remember landing with the snow shower starting the opposite end of the runway. And I couldn't taxi off the runway. It was so bad. You had to sit there and wait until the worst of this snow shower had come past, because the hardest thing was trying to find your way around after you'd landed.
I never did.
I was at Wharton doing the sort of, we called it Case White, but one of the, you know, early Eurofighter kind of getting used to the aircraft. Probably had about 3 or 4 hours on one of my trips, and we were doing night flying. It's probably my first night trip, and it was forecast for a bit of fog, but it was a pretty great night, and we were airborne and stuff. And then suddenly you could see this sort of bank, even though it's night, of fog, and we ended up, obviously it's light winds in fog, so we just landed on the opposite direction, and you know, two-thirds of the way down the runway taxiing was quite difficult, but you know, it was fine to get the aircraft in, but we couldn't have landed the other way. Massively localized, you know, it can be. But that's weather, you know, it's something that can bite you. You generally have you always have a diversion that you know is somewhere that you can go. But like Dunk says, if they change in the air, every now and again, you haven't got fuel to get there, you know, and then you're poorly placed.
Yeah. Dunk, you just mentioned the Aleutian, did you say 76?
I think it's a 76. I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so 76.
Candid. Is it Candid?
Candid. Candid, yeah.
In Manchester, at least we used to, I don't know if it still lands now, but we used to have a weekly service from the Antonov, I want to say 225. Is the 225 the two engine, the four engine or the six engine? The four engine version.
Okay.
Which is a severely cool aircraft.
Where was that going, JB?
Is that a transport aircraft, JB?
Yes. Yeah,
the Condor, I think, isn't it?
No, the Condor is the six engine one. So there's a four engine one. And I'm not sure if that's maybe it's a 223 or something like that, but I think it's 225. So we've got that one that's come into Manchester. And I also saw one, believe it or not, when I landed in Cape Town. And that was extremely exciting for everyone on the aircraft. Well, me, not everyone else on the aircraft. But it was very exciting. It was very exciting to see one.
They had a lot of Russian hardware out in Afghanistan. And they had I can't remember the name of it, but they had the biggest helicopter in the world.
Oh, the MI-8.
The Halo, is it?
Yeah, massive, just enormous machine. And they also had the six-engine version of what you were talking about, which has got it's got a strange tail on it, hasn't it? It's got a twin boom tail.
Oh, yes, I know it. Yeah.
But they also had these Aleutian 76s that looked like they were... they were sort of mercenary, they might well have been sort of mercenary machines. They were absolutely knackered. You would never, ever get in one. They just looked so beaten up that, you know, what was the CIA outfit that,
Air America?
Air America, that. It looked like Air Russia. But these things would pitch up and sit on the pan and then and within with regularity.
Are you thinking of the MI8? Is that the one? It's like a huge. It looks very, very agricultural, to put it politely.
I don't think it is, because that's the hip, isn't it?
Yes.
The MI8. No, we saw
that's
those.
Big. Actually. It's much. Yeah, they are big. I'm sure it's called the Halo.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's the Halo. The I went and sat in a in the hip over in Sri Lanka. The Sri Lankans had them. There's an
MI26.
We're just throwing those names out.
No, no, it is the MI26, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, it's bloody massive.
Yeah. What I like about them is they always seem to make like they all seem to look slightly different compared to the very clean Western aircraft. So they're always a bit beaten up, and they're always belching out some sort of black smoke.
Yeah. But
that's the Russian concept, isn't it? They are all their even their jets, their fighters are. Rugged, for want of a better word. You know, they can operate snow and dust, and they're just, rugged aircraft that will, take a beating.
Well, it's funny you mention that. Have you seen on the MiG-29, they have inlet covers? So when you're taxiing, they have the air come through the top of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And inlet, I think that's just a very clever little idea.
Well, because their runways are so, we call it FOD, foreign object damage, but, stones, anything, certainly F-16 Typhoon with the intake underneath you, it is like a Hoover. You know, you literally Hoover the airfield to keep it clean, but stones and any bits of metal and nuts and bolts going through, a £1.5 million engine is not good for it. So, NATO bases are beautifully clean of FOD, whereas Russian ones, they're just not the same, and that's why. If they didn't have things like that, they would trash their engines all the time.
And that voice there is Parky. How how are you, mate?
Yeah, that's the longest intro ever, I think. Or wait to be introed.
Did your heart skip a beat when you heard about the intercept over London and Cambridge? Did you wish it was you?
We were saying about a question and it all came. I couldn't have had a better introduction because that, before we start, I said, I've got a bit of a question I'm going to ask the boys. It might induce a bit of conversation because we're sure we all know what we're talking about. But it was to do with that. And it was, the boys cleared high speed. So, whatever it was, an aircraft that wasn't behaving or wasn't talking to the right people, the boys were told to go intercept it rapid. And, you know things are serious when you're cleared high speed. Which means you can go supersonic over land. And as most of Cambridge found out, as we talked about, the boom can be quite impressive. And that's what it was, yeah.
How high do you need to be? Or does it not matter when you make that boom?
So I may as well go. This is so when we were discussing this, we were just talking about, the boom and stuff. So I was talking with James, so he's going through pilot training at the moment, and my wife. So it's almost that sort of thing. What's that about then? So, the speed of sound, the sonic boom, when you go through the sound barrier, just the noise of the aircraft going through the sound barrier faster than the speed of sound makes a boom as the shock wave makes that noise through the air mass. Clearly, if you are lower, and, I think, the car that they're trying to build, is it Bloodhound or whatever, their plan is to go supersonic at low level, and the Eurofighter, I guess we can certainly, the F3, you can go supersonic at low level, and if you went, there's videos you can Google, YouTube, F-18s going past a carrier at low level, it's a hell of a boom, and you can see the supersonic shockwave on the aircraft. So I'm sure it has to be noisier the lower and the closer you are. I thought the physics of that, on that one. But my question was going to be, and maybe start with Dunk, as a QFI and very, very knowledgeable aviator. But just on the, it was really to do, we were then talking about, what is the speed of sound? It's Mach 1. What is Mach? This thing, and how does that vary? And, we were talking about, going up with height and how the Mach number varies. So, your indicated airspeed, the amount of molecules as you go up the atmosphere is very, very thin. So you're going for the same amount of particles of air. You're going much, much faster. So, you know, an airliner might only be doing 250 knots indicated, but if he did that at low level, he would be going twice the speed possibly when he's up high. And JB, you probably understand all this stuff. I don't know.
No, but I don't.
Maybe Duncan, just explain Mach number to us as a start of the 10.
So just so start of the 10. So just before,
it would have been nice if you'd have.
No, that's the thing.
But you're right. But I guess the speed of sound, it exactly as you've said, it depends on, you know, the thickness, the amount of molecules that it's having to pass through, isn't it? So, and it depends on what the Mach number, or the Mach number will always be the same. It'll say one, whatever you are, whether you're at low level or high level, and the change will be the airspeed that you've got on there, the indicated airspeed. The true airspeed should be about the same, I think, which is around about 600 odd miles an hour. I can't, 632 rings a bell, but I might have that slightly wrong. But that's you'll be going the same rate over the ground at Mach 1. It's just that your airspeed will be different.
Sorry,
exactly. Now go with that. Now, Dunk, the thing that it said, though, when we looked at it, actually the function of Mach number when you go supersonic, it's actually, rather than I thought, will it be thinner air, that's just going to make it easier to go supersonic, if you see what I mean. But in the book, Googled it, and it said actually it was temperature was actually the key, is temperature. And the lower the temperature, the molecules are less active, so sound doesn't travel less. So because it's freaking cold up at height as well, that minus 50 degrees or whatever it is up at height, that it's the equation of Mach numbers. He's a clever geezer that invented this stuff. Is to do with temperature as well.
Hang on. We just need to all calm down a bit. So you've got four measures of speed there, and I don't know what all these measures necessarily mean. So you've got.
To be fair, JB, I've got absolutely no clue what they're talking about either. So
yeah, but you have people for this. It's fine. So we've got the Mach number. You've got your indicated airspeed. You've got your airspeed and you've got your ground speed. Why don't you explain those four concepts before you try and explain exactly how they relate to each other?
So, your indicated airspeed is just, you know, it's like the speed I want a car. So when you're on the ground, you're doing 250, the amount of molecules coming through your pitot, so it measures the pressure. The faster you go, the more pressure on a dial, and it tells you the speed you're doing. That's the indicated airspeed.
Okay.
So if you can imagine, if you put your hand out of a car driving along, you stuck your hand out the window, and my son explained this to me, so he was taught it, you know, in Mach number. If you were in a speedboat and you're doing 25 knots in that speedboat, you put your hand out and your hand gets blown back a little bit. If you were to put your hand in the water, it would feel like your hand was being wrenched off.
Yes.
Because it is a denser, that fluid is denser than the air.
Yes.
But your speed hasn't changed at all. And that's kind of what it is like going up at height. Your speed doesn't change, but it will show you you're going slower because there's less air up at height. So maybe another way of thinking about
less
it,
pressure.
We then, the pressure there. But we then Googled James May having a flight in a U-2.
Yes, I've seen that.
You know, don't know when that was. You probably remember that. So he went up to 70,000 feet. And you can actually see, because James went, well, a U-2, that'll go supersonic, won't it? It's like, no way, mate. It's like a glider. The wings would come off that U-2 if it went supersonic. No way. And I happen to know, I can remember talking to some of the boys, chatted to a U-2 pilot, and it was something, and it is the top Mach number that a U-2 can go is about 0.7 Mach.
Yeah.
So at low level, it can go, you know, quite fast, you know, maybe about sort of 400 miles an hour, which is 0.7 Mach, a 7/10 of the speed of sound at low level. But when he goes up into that thin temperature, cold air at height, 0.7 at 70,000 feet is about 100 miles an hour indicated. The amount of molecules he's pushing through his little indicated airspeed. And we actually froze the screen. And it would say he's doing 100 in his HUD, 100 knots, but it's 0.7 Mach. And I do remember, God, as I can always remember, when we sort of got the typhoon and we could go up to 50-odd thousand feet, which we used to regularly, we'd go at 50,000 feet. If we went above, I seem to remember it was about 220 knots, we would go supersonic. But 220 indicated that is quite slow for a typhoon. And the alpha, when we talked about this one before, the angle of attack, it's getting maybe a bit technical, but that was starting to build. So we were almost, we're flying nearly supersonic, but we're actually, we're over land, we can't go supersonic. So we have to stay subsonic, but we cannot go any slower, or the aircraft is beginning to fly too slowly with the amount of particles of air up there.
Wait, I need to work this out now. So my first thought was, your indicated airspeed, what a rubbish instrument. Because the higher you go, the less accurate it becomes. So you need to kind of reference that against your altitude.
You had an auto throttling in Typhoon. So you would generally just fly indicated on the auto throttle below, God knows, what do you reckon, about 10, 15,000 feet, and then you'd always fly Mach above that.
The indicated airspeed, just let me go back to this a second. You said the indicated airspeed was low. Now, does that mean when you're higher up, you need to fly faster to avoid stalling?
Yes, technically.
Correct.
That's why it doesn't necessarily...
Yeah, that's why you need that relationship, JB, because ultimately, as the guys have said, it's pressure over the wings giving you the lift and that sort of stuff that you're not going to get because the air is thinner. And so you need to understand your indicated airspeed, because that's the thing that's going to keep you airborne.
I never knew that.
It is different. And true airspeed is essentially your speed through the air, as your speed over the ground would be. Ground speed could be different to true airspeed because you might be flying into a wind not going as fast.
There's a billion other airspeeds as well, isn't there? There's calibrated airspeed, all sorts of stuff. There's a lot where they actually take out some of the variables that you can amass in how these airspeeds are calculated. They go, right, we'll take that out, and that's calibrated. But going back to the U2, because that's an interesting story, I remember as well, same deal, but just to show the sort of level that these guys had to concentrate, that the difference between the stall, so the lowest airspeed, and that they could fly when they were at 70,000 feet or whatever altitude they were at, and overstressing the aeroplane such that it became... it broke the aeroplane, was about 2 miles an hour. So they had a 2-knot difference, and they had to fly within 2 knots. Otherwise, they were either going to stall or overstress the aeroplane.
Is this on a U2?
Yeah. On a U2. So what Dunks just said, that's why you could almost work out. I wonder what the ceiling of a U2 is. And I don't know if it's, does the U2 still fly, or is it out of service?
No, the Dragon Lady still flies.
Still around. Yeah. So that's probably why it is, fairly secret. And nobody knows, I don't know how high it actually flies. But what Dunk just said, when you looked at that thing on James May, you could see it was flying at 100 and it stalls at about 70 something or other. So it wasn't at its peak height. So maybe it'll go up to 80 odd. Whereas Dunk just said, top speed, because it can only go this speed is 0.7 Mach. It cannot go a low level, that's 400. But a height at when the air is so, so thin, that is possibly, I don't know, at 80,000 feet, that might be 74 knots indicated.
Hang on a minute.
But the thing will stall at 72. Do you know what I mean? So you've got such a tiny, you either overspeed or you fall out of the sky.
Right. So this is a question which I've never even thought of, but I think you've kind of answered it. Is the limiting factor of a U2's height the thinness of the atmosphere? And when that it can no longer get the airspeed needed to go over the wing, the indicated airspeed?
I would say yes.
Yeah, because otherwise it might depart. I mean, it's difficult to know because there will be other factors that mean, the performance of the engine, etc., that, it can't get any further thrust to enable it to overcome the fact that the air is so thin. So there may be other factors in there. But it could well be that controllability is one of the is the limiting factor.
But ultimately,
that was one of my favourite missions in the F-16. We did it in when we were doing Southern Watch just in 2001. And we would, as a wild weasel, so we'd be carrying the high-speed anti-radiation missile, the HARMS. We'd be following around the U-2 at a distance behind it, as it did its sort of photography runs around the place, ready to shoot anyone who was going to shoot at it. But it was really cool because the thing was ridiculously difficult to find on radar, especially an F-16 radar, because of the altitude it was at and just because of the nature of the aeroplane. And oh dear,
what happened there?
Someone
didn't like your dit, goddess.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's probably George, my son, on his Xbox. I'll close the door.
That was the FBI breaking into the wrong house to try and stop the story being told.
Quick, aren't they? Blimey! Yeah. All we said was U2 top height.
But it was. But it was flipping brilliant because it was a real game of cat and mouse as to, the guys who were following you in, when they were going to go to the tanker, when we were going to go to the tanker, how you were going to do the handoff, how you were going to find the U-2, what he was saying on the radio, and so on. So, massively enjoyable and an amazing aeroplane considering, I guess, it flew in the 50s, did it? The first version of it?
Yeah. I think the fuselage is actually from a starfighter, isn't it? It's a mental starfighter with the same middle section, and instead of the smallest wings in the world, the biggest wings in the world. And if you look at the tail and everything, it's kind of similar.
Yeah.
But I think that's the design tail. So that is, I guess, would that be early starfighter, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s? Yeah. I got scrambled in Cyprus once we were doing Q, and got scrambled to intercept. It turned out to be a U-2. And it was on a Phantom in sort of, I guess, in 1990. And, a two-tank Phantom, we got up to, I don't know, maybe the high 40s, and the old girl was falling out of the sky. And eventually we got sniffs of the radar, and he was above us. And then we got tally on this U-2, saw the thing. And it was, 3 miles away above us. And we were, the men was like, well, it's a U-2. We will not give you the tail number of this bad boy. It's just, it was ridiculous how high this thing was. Unbelievable.
Now,
Gary Powers was shot down in 1960, by the looks of things.
There you go.
So, clearly, 50s. It was 50s, yeah.
Now, that might have been the first trip, though.
It was the Skunk Works aeroplane, wasn't it? Same as the SR-71.
Yep.
U-2. So it was the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works that designed it.
So I'm just trying to.
Now, I tell you what, that is a book. If you haven't read it, we haven't done a book recommend for a while. I haven't.
We did that one of the early ones, didn't we? Ben Rich, Skunk Works.
Oh, did we? Well, in that case, I apologise for reiterating it. But yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely worth a read. I tell you what, we have done though. So we've got 100 plus years of flying experience between us, and not one of us
between all four of us. I might add. What...
Say again.
Between all four of us, I might add.
Between all four of us. And not one of us has been able to properly explain the relationships between IAS, indicated airspeed, true airspeed, ground speed, or Mach number. So any of you young pilots listening out there,
it's not necessary, is it?
School, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We might have dumped that knowledge.
I thought we did a pretty good job, didn't we?
Yeah, that was very formative. Crystal clear.
As long as JB
complicated.
Understood it.
Parky's explanation about the speedboat and the I thought that was good.
Only because that was what my lad was taught. That was his analogy, and he was he was trying to help me out, get head around it. But
poor old dad.
I tell you, the time flies by in our house.
Fascinating. So we can have flying conversations.
Yeah, very cool.
So are you boys familiar with the lightning intercepts of a U-2, allegedly that took place above 70,000 feet? Does that sound realistic to you?
In a ballistic kind of way, I reckon. What do you think, Parky?
Yeah, I reckon, I know the lightning went up to, silly heights. The U-2 boys wear full spacesuits. They're in, astronaut stuff, so that if you were to lose your canopy, rapid decompression, it's okay in a spacesuit. for some lightning mate, you know, with his oxygen mask on, I think his eyeballs would bulge a little. You know, it would be.
You would be brutal. Arnold Schwarzenegger at the end of Total Recall.
Exactly. Have we done, JB, you know, when we do the rapid decompression, have we ditted on about that before? You know, when we do pressure runs and we do sort of aeromedical training.
I have never heard you talk about any of that. I didn't even know that was a thing. So the answer is no.
So rapid decompression, essentially, you know, imagine if you're on your airliner, that would be pressurized, whatever it is, to, I don't know, 8,000 foot, whatever the cabin pressure is, it is pressurized. So your ears do pop a little bit as you go up and down.
Yeah.
But if you've seen on all the movies, if a window got smashed, the pressure would suddenly be great inside and it would decompress. So everything would actually get sucked out the windows. You kind of see the pressure change. So it's a bit like for Fast Jet Boys and, you know, for that lightning mate, as we talked about, if you canopies have, we talked about it before, didn't we? With Cab, lost his canopy airborne. But at height, rapid decompression, either your system fails, so the cabin pressure system might fail, or, you know, canopy gets smashed or whatever, disintegrates. It decompresses. So we go to a chamber. So they tell you the day before, you know, we're going to make sure you get a medical, make sure your ears are okay. And then I think it used to be, what was it, 25 to 40,000 feet. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Boys?
Definitely.
Something. So it's not a brutal one. So you suddenly, literally suddenly go from 25,000 feet to 40,000 feet.
All of the gases in you expand. So it's Parky's dream. It's an absolute dream for Parky.
So you've generally been to a curry the night before and had a few beers, which you probably shouldn't do. And,
in fact, they specifically tell you not to do that, don't they? So, of course, we all go and do it.
you see it as a challenge, JB. But, and the weird thing is you're looking at each other. So you're in this sort of tube and there's maybe eight of you in it and a safety guy. And you've done hypoxia a bit, so you take the mask off and you learn to kind of the symptoms of if you haven't got enough oxygen. So it depends how high you are. But, you know, again, we all take it as a challenge. You'll probably start to, you know, utterly not be able to make any sense and really start, you know, you can't write or you can't read, but maybe after about a minute
they give you some, well, it's quite interesting, is it, because they used to give us tasks to do. So for instance, you might get a simple mathematical task. Well, it's simple for most. I found it quite tricky.
You were struggling to begin with, though, Duncan.
With 100% oxygen. But it's just, count to 10, Duncan.
Start at 100 and take away.
Can you give
seven?
Me more oxygen?
107. No, take it away, Dunk. 9. No, 7.
85. Okay.
So, they would give you a task like that, or they'd get you to draw. And they also had coloured charts on the wall, didn't they? Because some people would lose colour perception. And so what they were trying to do was just show you what symptoms you would have if you felt lightheaded, as you became hypoxic, if it was not a rapid decompression, but you just lost air pressure and lost the oxygen system.
And that's definitely happened, JB. It's such a good tool to be able to recognize your own symptoms, you know, which is actually, you feel a bit euphoric is the main one, I think, you know, a little bit lightheaded, almost like you had a couple of beers and it's like, that feels weird. And, you know, so long as boys then go, I'll check my oxygen, and it could be that it's come disconnected or, you know, system malfunction. But that has definitely paid dividends, knowing, you know, I know Typhoon boys who've had, you know, recognised symptoms and then gone to, you know, either that you generally have an oxygen bottle in virtual aircraft, an emergency oxygen, if the system's oxygen you suspect might be contaminated or something wrong with it. So it's good to do.
Now, the higher up you go, I mean, it goes without saying, the more serious it gets. What is the most serious iteration of decompression?
Well, can I tell a quick story first? It is my favourite ever decompression story.
What?
Which was
of all of the decompression stories.
Of all of the decompression stories, because there are quite a few of people's head exploding and all of those. But I'm not going to name him, but it's a guy that the three of us know very well. He's out of the Air Force now.
Go on.
But
no. Go on.
And you'll see why in a minute. But I was absolutely crying when he told me the story. I wasn't there, but standard curry the night before the full whatever it was, 40,000 foot decompression.
Yeah.
And, you know, so everyone's a little bit rough in the chamber. There's five of them in the chamber, and they do all the pre-checks and everything. You get to whatever it is, 25,000 feet, and they go, right, decompressing in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, the place clouds up. It goes misty. And they put it's like a marigold glove. Do you remember that on the in the wall in there? When you decompress, this thing inflates to about 9 times its normal size because of the pressure and the volume change inside the glove. So obviously this is happening in amongst all of our bodies and everything. And they go, right, round the room. Thumbs up if you're good. Number one, thumbs up. Number two, thumbs up. Number three, thumbs up. Number four, thumbs up. Number five, massive thumbs down. They go, number five, you're right. And he points to his guts and just, and just says, no. And because at the point of decompression, he'd fully let go. And and filled his flying suit with...
That's vile.
With the remains of last night's current in this chamber. And apparently, you know, the people are in there, their eyes are starting to burn. full smoke and fumes on this thing. Everyone's like, what?
I just love the fact it's just a thumbs down.
Big thumbs down, massive grin on his face, and he's crapped himself.
That's disgusting.
So they end up, you know, repressurizing the thing. People are flying out the side of this thing as soon as they open the door, going, oh! As they get out. And the funniest thing is...
Surely they must have been crying laughing as well, though.
Can you imagine?
How could you hold it together?
I'll tell you guys the name afterwards, but it wouldn't be a surprise to know that the fella, once he'd tidied himself up, got changed out of all of his stuff, had a shower and done all these things. Being him, he put it all in a bin bag and gave it back to the safety equipment guys in this bin bag and went, you may want to burn this.
Brilliant. There is something exceedingly funny just because you're sitting opposite each other. So when it happens and, you know, you do get gut ache and obviously all the air inside of you is expanded massively. And just looking at each other's eyes as it happens, it is a ridiculous, amusing experience that's happening as well. The thing then, have you all done the pressure breathing?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And you have to sort of say your name. So when you've sort of 45,000 feet, to make, again, help me out here, boys, but to make sure you get enough oxygen actually going into your body, you actually have to pressure breathe. So it is forced into you, JB. And so you naturally... When you relax, you have to inhale and then you exhale the air, blow it out. It's the opposite way with pressure breathing. If you relax, you just fill up with air and you have to force and speak and exhale so forcibly to get rid of the air. You then just relax for a nanosecond and you're like the Michelin Man. You are. It's like somebody stuck a hose down you with enormous PSI. And then they get you to speak as if you have to speak on the radio. And there is something so comic about seeing Dunk trying to talk, knowing that as soon as he stops, he blows up. And then people start laughing. And as soon as you start laughing, you are just filling up with air. And it is ridiculously comedy.
So, can I just interrupt you there? Because when you're talking about this, it has revived a memory. I saw this show, God knows how long ago. But it was called, I want to say something like Michael Portillo, How to Kill a Human. And I'm pretty sure he got to the...
What?
Are you sure that he actually on TV?
Yeah. So he goes
around... What
channel
was that on, JB?
This is BBC, ages ago.
The dark web, yeah.
Yeah. It's quite sexy. Anyway, he goes around all the ways you can kill a person, visits America. Obviously, they've got death sentence there.
Hang on. What? I mean, does he go through... snowblowers?
No, he's looking at legal ways to execute prisoners and what people do.
Okay.
So it's like how to kill
the program
and all the ethical contortions which go with that, right? And I'm pretty sure they come to the conclusion that the most humane way to kill a person and how he nearly dies is in a decompression chamber at 29,000 feet or something like that. And he can't stop laughing, which is when they had to repressurize him.
That's probably a hypoxia thing.
Hypoxic, yeah.
Yes, I think now. Yes, I think that makes sense now.
Which is why we do the training, is because you don't know it's happening.
It's so insidious that you've got to be able to. And everyone has different symptoms, but you need to recognize your own symptom. Or your own symptoms, and that's why they do it, because it's not the same for everyone.
I tell you my major symptom, so I really do know what's coming on, is I feel brave.
Yes, well, that is very unusual.
That's so out of character. You should know that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as I start feeling brave, I'm checking oxygen going 100%.
They repressurize you.
So if you heard a supersonic shockwave and you looked up and went, I wonder what that was, you know you're hypoxic.
Yeah, if I'm not on a hedge, somebody's gone off.
It's like Dunk's hyperglycemia.
Oh, no, that's dangerous.
That is actually dangerous.
Yeah, don't go near him when he's hanging.
So is everyone's symptoms, are everyone's symptoms individual?
I would say they kind of are a little bit. It's a bit like, you know, if you're drunk, are they all the same? You know, some people get quiet, some people get loud, some people. It's kind of like that. I think most people feel lightheaded, I think. Some guys really like it, don't they? And some guys get clammy and it's an unpleasant feeling. Whereas, I don't know if it's half and half. Some people are like, I love it. It's a great feeling, you know.
I didn't love it. I could work through it. You know, the last time I did it, they've changed it slightly where you're not in a decompression chamber. They stick you in a sort of hawk trainer and you're wearing an oxygen mask and they start decreasing the oxygen flow that you're getting. And, I have this sort of a feeling that, you know, I kind of do feel, you know, it's almost the single beer buzz you start feeling. But then I'm kind of flatline for quite a long time before I start going downhill, which is bad because, you know, I need to know that beginning one because I can live with it for a little bit or for a while, but then when I hit the wall, I go downhill fairly quickly after that.
Ah, how interesting. I had no idea that... now you mention it, it makes sense that there's a thing, but I had no idea that you even trained for it.
Well, there's a load of people, aren't there, who...
overconfident and euphoric, and that's the problem, is you've got to fight against that because you're feeling, you know, as God has said, invincible. Hey, this is great, feeling good, and then suddenly you're can't asleep. Work controls anymore.
Crikey.
The final one, JB, in terms of while we're on physiological training and stuff, have we talked about centrifuge before?
Yes, a little bit.
So that's the final one, you know, so where you and all the boys now go fast jet, you know, obviously pulling G, you know, like we did, I remember, because it was the James Bond analogy, didn't we? We were in Roger Moore, get spun around.
Yes.
But that's the other thing that the boys then have to do which is pretty brutal. You know, that's G, because all the blood obviously pooling to your feet in the G suit, but you have to strain and fight. And, you know, basically get beaten up in a centrifuge for sort of 10 minutes or so.
So that used to be in Farnborough, did it not?
It's now, I think, at Cranwell, isn't it? The centrifuge? Have they got one there?
Yeah,
they
have. Yeah, we did talk about this. Yeah, we spoke about it.
Yeah, we did.
Because I went and did it. I remember we spoke about this, the new centrifuge, which is pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah, so you do all of that physiological training, JB, and then you do the other aspects of parachute jump training without actually jumping out of an aeroplane. Sea training, where you get thrown in the sea with all your kit on and dragged behind a boat so you can get out of it and get into your dinghy, those sorts of stuff, and land survival as well. So all of that whilst you're going through sort of basic training, just to you're either pre-basic training or in basic training to get you used to all of these sorts of things that might either happen to you in an emergency or you know, end up with you outside of the aeroplane that you started in.
Incredible.
The Dutch, I remember, this is now talking a drill story, but I don't know if I mentioned this one, but it just made me laugh. The Dutch, a really clever system. They used to do a parasail for their yearly, I think it was always yearly, you do your power drills. And you would, you know, behind a speedboat in a lake, you'd have all the kit on, and they had loads of lakes in Holland, and you'd get airborne on this sort of speedboat, dragging around on this parachute. And it would get you up to, I don't know, maybe 100 foot. And then the little matey boy would sort of shout up at you on a speaker, go, right, do your para drill. So you'd inflate your life jacket, which was more of a rubber ring kind of thing, bizarrely, at the time in the F-16 kit. But you then dangled the ejection seat would have a dinghy. So you'd drop the dinghy and that would auto-inflate below you. And then they would reduce the speed of the speedboat and you would float down, land in the water and do your para drills. And then another mate would go behind the speedboat, and there may be six of you bobbing in the water. And I watched this dude do the same thing, and he floated down. He'd done his drills. He had his dinghy below him. As his dinghy, I don't know, maybe 10 metres below him, it hit the water. He landed in the dinghy. He didn't go through the bottom of it, just landed in the dinghy and just went whoop, out. And kind of like was completely dry and went, hey, get me out. And all the little boys around him, we just applauded him. It was like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. That's the way to do it.
Isn't it just? Well, we've been chatting for 54 minutes now, boys. So why don't we get some questions?
That was good. And without lifting getting behind the curtain for everyone listening, clearly we plan all of those segues in advance as to where we're going to go.
Tell you what, we really got into nitty gritty of tall boy bombs, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, well,
there was no
stone left unturned there.
And the way we managed to make it sound like we had no idea what Mach number was. That was clever.
That was very clever. Fair play, boys. Fair play. What perfect.
Right, here's a couple of questions from this evening. Thanks to everyone who's sent a question in the last couple of hours. One here from Alex Dean, Plastic Pilot 1. I hear a lot of stories of how intense advanced fast jet training at Valley is. What would you say are the biggest challenges for students there, and how much has it changed since you did the equivalent course? Well, I guess the first thing to mention is ITV did a really good series. I thought it was really good. Was it last year or the year before?
Yeah.
I think the year before last, which may well be available on Catch Up on YouTube. But I think that is really good at showing what the students go through. But over to you guys.
I think Dunk should start, really. He's the qualified flying instructor.
Well, how much has it changed? You know, as the kit has improved, and we've got Hawk T2 now, we've got Texan now, and indeed we've got Prefect, then it's changed subtly. I'd say the foundation, the very basics of it has stayed very much the same, in that you are learning to operate faster and faster aeroplanes. And you learn to fly initially in the elementary and to a certain extent, the basic stages of it. And then as you get towards the end of your basic stages, you're then starting to venture into operating the aeroplane. So using the systems on them. And that's where the difference is now with the modern aeroplanes that we've got with the Texan. You can simulate weapons and weaponeering on it.
it's difficult to do combat in it. You could do it, but it doesn't really simulate combat as in jets, because they turn so tightly, these little aeroplanes. It's like a knife fight in a phone box. So you can't really simulate combat until you get to Hawk. So when you get to the Hawk, now you are the difference between when we went through, and I think, you know, you could group things like the Nat prior to the Hawk and then the Hawk T1 that the three of us went through on. Very little to it, just had the aircraft instruments in it. You might have a gun sight in, but very little other than that. And you were then learning to both fly and fight the aeroplane, whether that be weapons onto the ground or doing air-to-air combat and basic fighting maneuvers that we've spoken about before. Now we've got Hawk T2. It's got synthetic radar. It's got threat simulation in there. So there's now it's a much better way of training, and you're able to load up those pilots not only with having to think about flying the aeroplane on the edge of its envelope and to the highest of its performance, but you're also having to think about fighting. And also now you've got much more complicated weapon systems that you can train on, that you can train people to be able to manipulate the controls to simulate different radar states, etc., etc. So the advancement in technology has meant that we can train pilots much further or much earlier in the training system to deal with those not just flying the aeroplane, but operating it.
Right, that's very good and comprehensive. I know we did the podcast on that. We should have just said that, Dunk.
Yeah. Podcast number 8.
Yeah, because you were rubbish on the previous one, Dunk.
I'll try and think about Mac number for next time.
If you could, please. Hey, here's a good one. Hey, good answer, Dunk. Nice one. This one from Darren Hodgson. John Nicol, RAF, is reliving his Desert Storm 30 at the moment. And he is on Twitter. If you get a chance, follow him on Twitter, and you can see him talking about each day as it comes, getting to the point that him and John Peters were shot down. What were you doing at the time, and did it have any impact on how you perceived your RAF career? And that's a biggie for me and Dunk this week.
Yeah.
Or last week, I think it was.
Why last week?
We'll come to that in a second. Okay. But, Parco, what were you doing when the Desert Storm kicked off?
Well, I was on the Phantom, and I can remember exactly when I saw... Do you remember the front of the, you know, one of the papers? And it had, I think it was John, probably both their faces. I can remember John Peters. He was quite, you know, sort of looking at a slight angle, and then, yeah, John Nicol was, you know, sort of a bit bruised face and bashed up, and their face was on the front of the newspaper. And I read that newspaper article in the Falklands, and I remember, because I knew that both those boys, and you know, had done TAC weapons, I sort of knew John Peters, and it was like, oh my word, that's, you know, that's John, he's shot down, he's captured, you know, da da da. And I saw that in a newspaper in the Falklands. So I was doing my sort of, you know, 5 week stint down there at the time. And just a squadron mate on the Phantom.
What were we doing, Dunk?
Well,
you were we at were, school.
No.
Close, though.
We were at Royal Air Force College, Cranwell.
Cranwell. So Godders and I, on the 6th of January, where are we? So this time last week, were starting our Royal Air Force careers. Some were more successful than others.
You're still. See,
you had a second go at that, Dan, didn't you?
I did have a second go, yeah.
But it's funny about the impact, though, because Duncan and I were on the same flight, so we had we would have had a conversation about this, but I cannot remember
the same room. Well, yeah, not at the time.
At that particular time, but the the actual fighting kicked off. You know, clearly all of that stuff was going on out in the Middle East. We were reasonably, remember, time before internet, so you're reliant on the main news. And I remember doing a, we were what's called a bull night. So cleaning out our rooms, you know, you're absolutely scrubbing everything, making your, sure your bed's perfect. Then you sleep on your sleeping bag on your floor next to your bed so you don't have to make it in the morning. And I remember it was somebody on our flight, Dunk, came around the corner and said, hey, the war has just started. And we went, ooh. And I do remember having a conversation in the corridor about, blimey, you know, this stuff is kind of real. And do you remember over the following week, we lost a few people on the course who left because, you know, I guess they hadn't considered the fact that, you know, we're a war going military and you might be called to actually do something. So I can't remember how many, but
it was Green. Was it Greg Green?
I think Greg was. I was thinking of Greg. I think it was Greg who came and told us.
Yeah, because he was he was an ex-NCO, wasn't he? He was sort of a hairy.
And he had mates out there.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, he came around the corner. He was and said, yeah, that's it. We're at war. It was like, ooh, we've only just joined.
Yeah. And then I guess the thing for you,
I thought you were saying Greg Green was the one that quit. I thought, blimey.
Yeah. No, yeah. Yeah, no, he definitely wasn't. I think and I think then one of the bigger issues, Dunk, is that, again, no internet, no other than newspapers. When you're on IOT, initial officer training, you don't get a chance to have a relaxing breakfast and read the newspaper. And there wasn't much, if any, TV time at all. So we kind of missed most of what was going on in the major press and the news from what I remember, Dunk.
Yeah, we did. But it really, I don't know, it must have been, of course, after the event. But was it TVAM did a whole piece on the tornadoes out there? And it was to Bon Jovi's, it was a Bon Jovi song.
Living on a Prayer?
Or? On the Steel Horse I Ride, whichever one that is. But anyway, it was, and it was a pretty well put together film, which really, I think, again, spurred us on to get to be fast jet pilots. It really sort of, it was quite inspiring to see that blasting off.
I think absolutely 100% that as well. You know, it did give you more inspiration. And I tell you what, if you ever get a chance to hear either John Nicol, John Peters, you know, my old boss, Dave Waddington, talk about being shot down and captured, it is unbelievable. You know, I remember going to a combat survival rescue officers conference in about 94 maybe, and John Peters, you could have heard a pin drop in the room as he talked about his experience from, you know, the initial shoot down to being captured, being moved around, ending up in solitary, you know, all these sorts of, being bombed, you know, all of these sorts of things. And you know, what struck me from that one was at least three or four times, maybe more than that, in his presentation, in his speech, he said, at that point, I knew I was going to die. And, you know, not I thought I was, I knew I was. And I just remember being absolutely gobsmacked listening to this. Yeah. And only a couple of years ago, Dave Waddington talked about, I got into talk to the team that I worked with about his experiences, and he was hit by it was a low-level Roland missile, and as it was his navigator that actually punched him out in the end. But he remembered, you know, there was a huge explosion next to the aeroplane, you know, the canopy disappeared, big light and flash, and Dave says he remembers pointing towards the ground. They're only at a couple of hundred feet, looking at this through the head-up display, and just thinking, well, that's it then. And, you know, sort of drifting into unconsciousness at that particular point. And then he wakes up on the ground wondering how the hell he got there. But, he you know, a bit like John Peters was really accepting when they thought or knew that, hey, that's it. So the whole thing, if you get a chance to speak to those guys, if you get a chance to, I know John Nicol's doing a book, you know, he's done some brilliant books so far, Spitfire and Lancaster. But I think the next one's Tornado with a few of these tales in. I think that'll be a brilliant one to listen to an audiobook or to read as well.
Yeah, because it was definitely from the sort of Cold War that we were all geared to at the time. Suddenly the boys, you know, were out doing their stuff, and it was the tornado force initially, who, and it was, you know, we talked about when we all got posted, so you sort of go your separate ways, but you know, you knew the mates who went to fly the different aircraft. And the Bruggen, I was at Wildenrath in Germany on the Phantom, and Bruggen's only about sort of 6 miles away, so the Bruggen boys came over afterwards, and you know, sort of got together beers, and they gave a bit of a presentation. And like you got us, I can remember just, you know, it was eerily quiet as the boys just explained what it was like they did. And the thing I remember was one of the guys, it was the first mission, and it was just massive excitement, and they're going to do it, obviously a bit of fear, trepidation. Out they went at night, and they were doing the sort of, essentially have to fly down the runway, pretty much straight and level at a few hundred feet, not as low as they'd like to be, and lay this JP-233 to take out the runway. You know, it would fire down and create craters and do all sorts of stuff. A very clever weapon, but actually flying straight level and over an airfield, it's, you know, pretty high risk. And the boys went, and, you know, I guess it was a train of tornadoes going in to attack this airfield. And from, you know, sort of 40 miles away, they could just see, some of the boys had obviously gone through ahead, and they just explained it was like, it was lit up like daylight, you know, the, just the tracer, the explosions, that, you know, and they had 5 minutes almost just looking at this going, oof, you know, and it was on terrain following radar. The jet was flying itself, sort of thing. It was just bizarrely surreal. And then, you know, once you're in it, just the carnage, and then you're out the other side. And then, you know, they came back and it was like, holy shimoli. And then it was like, boys, same again next night. And then that really hit them, like, oh my god, now we know what we've got, you know. And it just fascinating, the human side of you know, of that just, sort of warfare. Very interesting.
Do you know what, I can't get over the fact that they're able to do that. Now, the fact that they don't deploy that, well, they don't use the tornado actually, but for a long time they didn't use the JP, what's it called, the JP2
233, I think.
The aircraft
runway denial. Yeah.
So the fact that they don't use that, I wonder if that was actually a case that you can no longer do it. Because if you think about the systems that you have on ships, like the goalkeeper system or the phalanx, or is it the Rheinmetall Sky Defender, which I've got? Is it Defender? Anyway. What? I mean, these things can shoot down missiles flying at Mach, whatever it is. I can't imagine that any tornado or anything flying low level now would have any chance.
Sure. Well, I think this is 30 years ago, isn't it? You know,
The JP-233 was actually banned, though, because it was classified as a mine, I think.
Yeah, the cluster munition ban.
It was then classified, I think it's Geneva Convention, isn't it, of a banned weapon. So that went out the window, and I bet the boys were pretty pleased it did, because, as you say, right, everyone go and fly straight and level over that heavily defended airfield. Okay, sir, right off we go. There's got to be better ways of doing it.
Have you seen, I can't remember what the German system is now. It's fairly famous. It's the air defence gun, which... the Rheinmetall one, I'm sure it is. Has anyone got any idea what I'm talking about?
None at all. We're all looking blank-faced.
Never mind. Do you know what? I will save it until I actually read up about it properly and can explain it. But they fuse each bullet as it comes out of the muzzle, and therefore it explodes at different times. It's a ferocious weapon. I just think, how on earth does anyone do anything with kit like that about?
Well, definitely. I've seen RoboCop, so that's probably good training for me.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be anywhere near it, pal. You'd be way behind.
Several countries behind. Hey, so if you want to read more about that, have a look at John Nicol at John Nicol RAF's Twitter feed, and you'll see some more. We'll go with one more, shall we? And I think this is a belter from Dil Patel. If you could pick an aviator from the past to have drinks with, who would it be and why? Parko. I mean, we're lucky to have...
You pick Parko?
...had drinks with... Yeah, I'd pick Parky. lucky to have had drinks with a fair few of them.
Can we pick who we, you know, one of those? Because for me, that is the no-brainer. I had so many brilliant drinks. I know Duncan, too, well, or the vets, it's, we bang on about it, don't we, so many times. But just amazing evenings that we've had, and definitely when you forge a bit of a friendship, it's just super special. But Jeff Wellham, I could never, ever, ever get bored of chewing the shit with Jeff, you know, just talking about aviation, ditting on like we are now, maybe not really knowing what we're talking about, but enjoying doing it. And he was that spirit that he had. He absolutely loved that crew and banter and just that world of aviation and that camaraderie. And yeah, absolutely wonderful. I miss dear old Jeff. Fabulous bloke.
And what about someone you haven't met who would have been...
That's a good question. You know, I would love to have, chatted to, the early NASA boys, you know, just, we're talking about the speed of sound earlier, you know, and just, it was, did you chat to Eric Winkle Brown? Have you met him, Godders?
No, unfortunately I didn't. I was going to get him to come back up to Lossie because he'd been a previous commanding officer at Lossie, but unfortunately we lost him just as I was taking command.
Okay. Maybe it was Jez Attridge actually that met and did you, Dunk?
I did, yeah. I had lunch with him, both with him and John Bell actually, and which was fantastic. So
yeah, well, I missed that, and there you go. That, so for me, everything you're about to say,
it was Tony Iveson. So and we're throwing these names out, but just to reiterate what Parky says, I mean, we've been just so lucky to meet these guys. Just amazing to sit in crew rooms or in bars and listen to some of their tales and what they did. Again, we have been lucky like that. But I think Chuck Yeager has got, you know...
Chuck Yeager's a great shout.
You've got Chuck Yeager to be able to just have a chat with him and just, you know, just talk to him about his experiences. It must have been astounding.
Yeah, Chuck Yeager would be a good one. And obviously, he departed for the crew room in the sky just the... December. Middle of December, wasn't it?
December 20th.
December last year?
Yeah.
And along those lines, one person I would have killed to have a beer with was Robin Ault.
Yeah.
So World War II, P-38s, P-51s, and then Korea, then Vietnam as well. And he only died a few years ago, but an absolute legend of a man. And anyone who'd ever met him said what a gentleman he was as well. And even up until, you know, into his 90s, he was always the last one to leave the bar, you know, loved that side of things. I think he'd be brilliant. But you're right, there are so many, you know, so many of those Sailor Malan, you know, I'd always thought that he'd be a good guy to go and see what he was actually like, or some of the aces. I remember I did a what they call a stand on a staff ride on staff college out in the desert in Egypt, and it was about Hans Joachim Marseille, who was killed in a Messerschmitt in the Second World War out in Egypt, but was on track. His curve of kills per flight hour was higher than anyone else, and you know, a real character apparently on the ground, you know, kind of hard to control on the ground, proper, I guess you'd say, fighter pilot. And unfortunately his engine seized and he ended up being apparently he was killed by his as he bailed out, he hit the tailplane. Ooh. And that was the end of him, but you know, apparently legendary down on the ground. There's so many of them, aren't there?
A little bit of a left field question here. But obviously, you guys have spoke to so many veterans because you're in the RAF. Have you ever encountered any of the Russian veterans or any of the German veterans?
German, well, yes, but not Russian.
We've got a bit of a recording, haven't we, Godders, of one of the German veterans.
I should dig that out, Dunk.
Yes, you should. So Godders and I, before all this dreadful COVID business came along, went to the Duxford Air Show, and we did a bunch of recording there. And I thought, I mean, I'm probably leading the witness, but I don't know what you thought. I thought it was pretty good, Godders. But it's remained on your iPhone ever since, hasn't it? So I think we should dig it out.
I will dig it out,
actually, because I remember we spoke about it at the time, didn't we, on the subsequent pod after that, but an amazing guy who talked about, you know, seeing his friend go in on one of those big flying bomb things that they modified the Messerschmitts to go and carry, that you were supposed to detach from. And it was essentially the German equivalent of a write to my wife and tell her that I love her kind of thing, as he then rode this thing in. And he was an amazing old fellow, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. It was a very emotional time, wasn't it? I mean, he was back there. He was reliving it, wasn't he, Goddard, when we spoke to him. I don't wish to make light of it sort of romanticize it, because it was quite a harrowing part. But, as you say, JB, it's fascinating to see that human side of things and what happened. He had a translator there because he didn't speak very much English, but... we'll try and get that up up on our podcast at some point.
Dunk, do you remember the it was a Focke-Wulf 190 pilot we met when we were in Canada doing an air show out there called Otto?
Yeah, no, I wasn't there.
Ah, it was 2002. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. But real short story. Just he did a glider display, which was absolutely brilliant, at the Toronto Air Show over the lake, and you sort of got air towed, did his glide a bit, and then just had enough energy after sort of looping and entertaining the crowd to kind of glide into a field over water, sort of crowd left, you couldn't really see where he went, and that was him. And we met this guy, and he was, you know, must have been, I guess, in his 80s sort of then, and it was just, you know, he had still had his German accent, and we just sort of chatted to him. But the short of it, he said, I was, you know, I was Hitler Youth glider, went straight to the Focke-Wulf 190 Eastern Front at the end of the war. I had a mid-air collision with the Yak. I bailed out. I broke my leg. I hit the tail, as I think a lot did. I was going to be executed, but they said they'd interrogate me. I managed to escape, and I walked 1,000 kilometers with a broken leg, and then emigrated to Canada. And it was wow, you know, that's quite a cool story. And exactly. And you know, again, just the stories that are out there, and we often mention it. You know, if you know any of these old boys, just talk to them, and you will not believe some of the stuff, you know, that they did. And that was his story. And we sort of, you know, went, yeah, we can't be that one. And we all...
Tell you what, glider to Focke-Wulf 190 is a bit of a step up, isn't it?
Yeah, from a glider, yeah.
Here's a challenge for one of you, or for all of you. I'd like us, just on the aviator stuff, I know we're talking about aviators of the past, but aviators of the present, if you can source us a Swedish aviator who has flown the array of really cool Swedish kits, or a English-speaking French aviator, I would love to speak to them.
Well, we can probably get an English.
We'll see what we can do, because
English-speaking French aviator.
Yeah, I mean, there must be loads.
Almost
of, fact, all of them are English-speaking, I'd guess.
Yeah.
The well, that's our New Year's resolution, isn't it? To try and find some guests this year to dit on about. Indicated airspeed in different languages.
Exactly.
The Mach number.
You can come out with his A2 questions.
Well, it's temperature dependent. I think he was an Austrian bloke, but that could be wrong, who invented it. Oh, God. I'll be quiet.
Didn't we once introduce Dunk as the only time he's seen a Mach number is on his razor?
Yeah, because then he flew Harrier. That's good. Yeah,
that is good. I tell you what, there's a bunch of loads of different questions in here. We're gonna have to do a podcast as well, where we just answer some of these flipping questions and just roll through these.
Why don't you do one more? And make it about hardware. Go on.
Make it about hardware. Hang on, let me scroll through. Ian Savage, has anyone flown the Harrier? ?
Oh God! 2 hours later.
How about it's Ian again? The one underneath it. Has anyone done a carrier-assisted launch and trapped landing? Thoughts? Unless you've, I'm owed one by the U.S. Navy after the last 6 months, but I couldn't go to the carrier because of COVID restrictions. But maybe I'll be able to do it in the next year or so. Would I don't know. We'll find out.
Would they let you on?
No, not in COVID land.
No, but in can you
imagine turning up and giving the entire carrier COVID?
No, no, but in normal times, could you just get an invite?
Well,
Depends who you are, JB. You
need to be kind of a big deal, JB.
I get that.
You've organised the sort of socials that God has organised.
Well, my thought is that the US Navy, unless I've got it wrong, don't they run dry ships? What would you be going there for?
Exactly. God has couldn't stand that.
Yeah,
no champagne.
No martinis on London.
I've been dry for the last 6 months. Easy.
What would they? What,
so no, I guess that means no. So,
but on a
are you doing dry or, January as well?
But on a serious note, though, Goddess, what would they do? Would they fly you out on? Would they fly you out on a helicopter, or would they fly you out on a Greyhound, or what would they do?
On business, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. With velvet cushions. Yeah, yeah, exactly that. All of the above, and you know, fortunately, they still have 2-seat aeroplanes up there because few and far between on all the modern aeroplanes at the moment. So, unfortunately, Ian, that is a that's a dud, that question, because none of us have actually done it, but we'll go and find someone who has.
Yes.
And there was a question on here that I thought was good about Tempest. Here we go, Paul Lawler. What performance would you be looking for from The Tempest, and is it ever likely to happen? Question mark.
Ooh,
so The Tempest being the new collaboration and industrial collaboration as well, and different air forces, lots of technology going into, I guess, the fighter of the future.
So was that a Mach number question? What Mach number would we be expecting?
Performance. Not quite.
0.82 Mach.
Have I been right?
It's a critical wing. Interesting.
0.87 at a push.
It's no longer just a UK project, is it? Is it Swedish as well?
Yeah, I think as far as I know, like I say, it's a big collaborative project at the moment. And you know, it really is about technologies at the moment and innovation. So they're looking at... We went and looked at the. Do you remember the mock-up at Farnborough Air Show?
Yeah, I remember it because you rugby tackled me away from the First Sea Lord. I remember it well.
Yes, weren't allowed to speak to the First Sea Lord. You weren't allowed to doorstep him, JB. But it's the sort of stuff that they had in there. You know, that virtual reality or augmented reality helmets. It'll be about networks. It'll be about decision making. I know everyone talks about artificial intelligence, but, you know, not in terms of flying the aeroplane, but in terms of looking at sensor feeds, bringing all of those sensor feeds together so you get a single picture of the truth that is offboarded to someone like me, for example, in the KAOC recently. All of those sort of different sorts of things I think we'll be looking at. I don't know what modern camouflage stealth is going to look like, you know, whether you have any sort of reactive visual camouflage, whether there's infrared radar camouflage, you know, all of those sorts of things, whether it's manned or unmanned. There's a ton of different things I think they're looking at in terms of what a fighter of the future is going to look like. And we're not the only ones doing it as well. France and Germany are collaborating on something at the moment. The US clearly are looking at all sorts of things in the future. China, Russia, all of this stuff is out there.
But when we get the first, as I believe it will happen, don't we get the first drawings of the B-21? Is it B-21? Next year or this year?
Yeah, which amazes me that stuff's going to be out in the public. But that'll be interesting. It's a long-range bomber, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's going to be the I think they want to replace all three of their current bombers, I don't have any proper knowledge of the thing.
But yeah, so I think Tempest is really exciting, just in terms of the technologies that they're looking at the moment. Stuff like new engine technologies, airborne lasers, all of these sorts of things that you could put on aeroplanes. And it'll be exciting to see what they come out with, because whether it appears as a specific aeroplane or not, those technologies are definitely going to appear in current or future aeroplanes.
I'll tell you, the technology which quite excites me is drones used as wingmen and using legacy aircraft to support the new stealthier aircraft. So have you seen the project to look at the F-15 as basically a missile truck?
Yeah, so I was about to say exactly that. You know, the Americans call them missile sleds. So it, exactly that. Unmanned aircraft, or what were manned aircraft, turned into unmanned, you know, drone is the wrong word, but to support piloted vehicles out there that can do the decision making for them. It's all pretty cool and exciting.
Interesting stuff.
I read in one of the magazines it wasn't using older legacy aircraft that were unmanned. The imagery I saw was of cheaper stealth machines, though, that effectively one pilot was controlling from his master machine, where, you know, and he was flying it and controlling a bunch of other unmanned aircraft with the systems that he had.
Yeah.
But they were all stealthy from what the... Yeah.
There's loads of different versions of it out there, Dunk, from, you know, exactly as you're saying, big, new, stealthy ones to medium to small, modern, brand new aircraft, carrying weapons, sensors, those sorts of things. So when, very much like now, you request, you put a sensor on a target, doesn't mean it's coming from your aeroplane. It could be that little miniature wingman that's got a targeting pod on it that is stealthy, that you've launched into the area and is data linking that picture back to you. So you're not using one on your own aeroplane. It's that sort of stuff, is exactly that. And there's a ton of different things out there that people are looking at. So there isn't one particular one. I think the Boeing Loyal Wingman has been in the news recently, which is probably the one you're talking about, which is exactly as you say, Dunk, you know, a sort of big stealthy looking drone. Drones for, I use the word drone, it is the wrong, but we all know what we're talking about. But refueling, you know, carrying fuel around there to top you up when you need it, that sort of stuff. Weapon sleds to, just as I said, you could have sensor sleds, weapon sleds, all of those sorts of things. There's some really cool ideas.
Tell me if I'm wrong on this, but just to give an indication of how good networking can be. Am I right? I'm going to sound like an idiot now. But did the Sea Harrier, say if you had two Sea Harriers flying, one Sea Harrier locked onto a target and then decided to fire, it would be the computer system that would decide which missile came off which rail on which aircraft, depending on positions.
No,
doable, but I don't think the Sea Harrier had that technology.
I'm certain the Mark II did, because I was listening to something, and I don't know why that rings a bell, but I'm pretty sure that the Mark II did actually.
I think as my knowledge of the Royal Navy will, how that data link will work will be one pilot saying on the radio, you fire, shipmate. And that's probably,
aye.
As far as it goes. Aye, aye, Captain.
I think that it might have chosen which missile was, you know, the left or the right would be the better one, but it wouldn't choose which aircraft.
No.
But that's the sort of thing of the future there, JB, exactly as you're talking about with, you know, you've got your armed wingmen around the place, you press the button to shoot at something and you don't know where that weapon is going to come from.
That would make you jump, wouldn't it, if suddenly it was yours? Have a real scream, Godders.
Yeah. I'd pass out.
It would be another, well, be another thumbs down moment.
I'd be on 100% oxygen.
Excellent. Right. Well, we'll leave it there. Actually, before we leave it there, can I'll just give a shout out to a different podcast, purely for the fact that I think listeners of this podcast will quite like a recommendation. So, in the spirit of the old book club things, have a listen to the Jeremy Paxman podcast, and he interviews a Royal Navy nuclear submarine captain or ex-captain, and it's absolutely fascinating. So I thought I would share that.
Nice one.
Well, as we're doing shout-outs, I said to some of the boys who are just starting one of the courses, Tom Napier and Jordan Capehorn are starting this brand-new Prefect to Hawk. So it's Prefect Basic Training at Cranwell this week. So if you're listening, hello, boys. And I've got a question as well whilst we're at it, which isn't related to flying. But if I can, I just thought, given these difficult times, I just ask Parky, how was the vaccine, mate?
Yeah, I was the first to get it.
Yeah.
Really good, actually. Yeah,
we'll all be able to meet up soon. On that bombshell.
Yeah, so let's leave it there. Right, you can find us at Pilot Episodes. Is it Pilot Episodes Pod? Twitter?
Yes.
Correct. And someone's mounting it. I'm not mounting it. Someone is mounting it.
Slick, JB.
You're the host, JB.
Park is all over it.
And that's it, really, because we'll be back soon. So me, Dunk, and Parky, we might have a guest, we might not. We might do all sorts. We don't know, do we? But watch your feed.
We have no idea.
We didn't even know what we were talking about
but
today.
We're going to keep them coming.
Yeah, but we'll just keep showing up, because that's the secret to success, isn't it, boys? Just keep showing up.
Keep showing up.
There you go.
Awesome.
All right. From me, Dunk and Parky, thank you very much. Goodbye.
See ya.
So.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.